On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Santorum's out, Zimmerman's in jail, we're back to the mommy wars, and a rocket's down in North Korea. George Zimmerman arrested and charged. Second-degree murder more than 6 weeks after Trayvon Martin's death. He made his first court appearance yesterday.
You are represented by Mr. O'Meara, is that true?
Yes, sir.
Remember your right to remain silent, all the other rights that he has told you about.
Out of nowhere, mommy wars again. Ann Romney fought back against a charge that she's never worked a day in her life.
My career choice was to be a mother. And I think all of us need to know that we need to respect choices that women make.
And a failed rocket launch in North Korea. It was blast off, then a blow up 80 seconds into flight. North Korea's official news agency acknowledged the failure.
지구 관측위성 광명성 3호가 궤도 진입에 성공하지 못했습니다.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, David Sanger of the New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Syria, Santorum, justice for Zimmerman, for Trayvon Martin, and Romney, the Buffett rule and taxes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Eleanor Clift joins us from Washington. She's contributing editor to Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Welcome back, Eleanor. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
David Sanger joins me in the studio. He's chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. His new book, Confront and Conceal, will be out in June. David Sanger, great to have you here.
Great to be with you.
And Jack Beatty is with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Eleanor, and David.
David Sanger, you and I go back to Tokyo days in Northeast Asia, and here's North Korea. We've all watched this rocket on the launch pad. They took foreign reporters out there and showed off all week, had big displays in downtown Pyongyang waiting for this thing to go off. 80 seconds, it was heading south, and boom, it's gone. How did they get over this embarrassment?
This one is pretty tough. You know, as we've all seen with North Korean launches before, you know, what's the old saying? Breaking up is hard to do. But if when it's a North Korean rocket, they've broken up now three or four. Now, we've had in the United States significant rocket failures before, too.
Sure,
This is a difficult technology. It's particularly difficult if you are the North Koreans. You have a hard time getting a lot of the parts. You're working on subpar engineering and so forth. That said, as you pointed out, they went way out of their way to advertise this one, bring reporters in. I've never seen that happen before in the quarter century you and I have covered North Korea, right? So this is going to be difficult, particularly because this was the first launch under Kim Jong-un, the grandson of the country's founder, Kim Il-sung. And, of course, the launch was in celebration of Kim Il-sung's 100th birthday. He died back in 1994.
It was kind of as big as it gets, and it was supposed to be the glorious moment that laid hands on his grandson.
That's right. So what do you do now? I think the answer is lying up in a tunnel near the Chinese border. We've seen satellite photos of recent activity to suggest a third nuclear test. They've been more successful in getting their nuclear tests going than the rockets, and if it's a failure, it's easier to hide.
An underground nuclear test. There has been talk that one might be coming. Maybe that's the way they get out of the red-faced moment.
Well, also remember that the rocket capability, while a demonstration of sort of old Cold War power.
And they said it was to put a weather satellite up, not to carry nuclear weapons.
That's right. And the weather satellite, they showed the weather satellite to the reporters, and there was a very good line from a member of the Obama administration who said that it looked a little bit like a refrigerator wrapped in tinfoil.
Okay.
And it did. It was about the size of it. It was sort of a small refrigerator size.
Okay.
But the important point here is that the technology for launching a satellite and the technology for launching a warhead are about the same technology. So the claim that this was supposed to be a space launch was a way to get around their earlier commitment that they wouldn't launch any more missiles. Let's set that aside for a moment. If North Korea ever launched a nuclear attack on anybody, nobody thinks it would be via a missile because the country
knows it's too traceable.
You know what would happen within the half hour. So the concern about North Korea has always been one of proliferation. Remember, they built an entire nuclear reactor in Syria, which the Israelis destroyed. There's been concern about whether they would sell nuclear material.
There was a link to AQ Khan, all the rest, Pakistan.
Right, that's right. And so in many ways, the rocket threat is a pretty minimal threat. The nuclear threat's another thing.
And yet, if I may, Eleanor Clift, this week, sitting and watching, and nobody wants war, but watching a missile sitting on the launch pad in a nuclear power like North Korea, just the idea that it could go somewhere, you have to think, Eleanor, that this would really have the Pentagon's riveted attention.
Oh, it did. And when it flopped, the White House took a long time before it put out a statement, because I think they were prepared for it possibly to succeed. And they're going ahead as though it succeeded and pressing the case before the Security Council, suspending food aid. They're treating it like a serious effort. And I think resisting any impulse to laugh or make fun of it, which is what the late night talk show people are doing. But that's not smart, because you don't know how this regime is going to respond. And if they feel they're being laughed at, they could lash out in ways that David referred to. I think the nuclear proliferation is a much more serious threat.
I suppose part of that laughter could be genuine relief here. Here's the South Korean foreign minister. This is expressing disapproval today over North Korea's attempted rocket launch.
Our government strongly condemns North Korea going ahead with the launch in disregard of the united calls from the international community to scrap it.
So, David, while we're on it, so what happens here? If there's another nuclear test, is there any more pressure to be brought to bear? If they keep on the rocket path, I mean, even when things blow up, you're on a learning curve. And we're talking intercontinental was the idea, or the fear here.
That's right. And Defense Secretary Robert Gates, on a trip to China last year, I was along on the trip, was the last one to speak about the missile threat in any detail among American officials, and said that he thought within 5 years they would have a missile that could reach the United States. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. The experience of the past three missile launches would tell you that probably we have some other things to worry about first. The nuclear capability, though, is another issue. If they do a test in the next few weeks, Tom, the thing to look for, while it sounds wonky, is actually quite important, is whether this would be the first test of a weapon made out of highly enriched uranium. Until now, they have made all of their weapons out of plutonium that came out of a reactor. They closed that reactor down in part of a deal— Under foreign pressure, and part of a deal with the Bush administration, the very end of the Bush administration. The reactor was in very tough shape. They're not likely to restart it. So their supply of plutonium is quite limited. Some people say 6 bombs, 8, 12. Okay. We have an interest in them conducting as many plutonium tests as we can.
Use it up.
It diminishes the amount. However, they about a year and a half ago, they showed a visiting American scientist named Zig Hecker out at Stanford, who used to be the head of the Los Alamos National Laboratories, that they have begun a new effort to make highly enriched uranium. And there they could keep producing the way the Iranians are. Same technology, same centrifuges bought from the same guy, AQ Khan, right? And so if they did those kind of tests, then it would tell you they were on another path. And that would be particularly concerning, because they would have an unlimited supply.
Let's get a call right here from Omaha, Nebraska. Paul, you're on the air, Paul.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just going to make the comment, you know, listening to the news stories about the fact that the North Korean government released the information about the failed rocket launch.
Yes.
It could very well be setting the stage for their next propaganda move in which they're going to blame the United States or other countries for having sabotaged the launch. And it may be a way of bolstering their position to continue to move forward on it.
You know, you could be right. I mean, that the kind of thing has happened in the past. On the other hand, what do you do when it blows up in the clear sight of the whole world and you've taken reporters to look at it, David?
Well, that's right. They were under greater pressure. But, you know, there's one other factor that's playing here that we haven't really thought about much in the U.S. before. In the past, because news was so controlled in North Korea, if something went wrong, you could simply not talk about it.
Yep.
Well, guess what? There are a million cell phones in North Korea now.
Okay. And what can they get online? Can they look at, I don't know,
people
Twitter?
Can't get online that much, but because they have cell phones, when those cell phones are down near the Chinese border,
they can talk.
And word will spread. So the ability of the North Korean regime, like the ability of every other government in the world, to keep secret a publicly failed test that the rest of the world know about, that day is over.
Jack Beatty, we've got a lot to talk about this hour, but this thing, it had me riveted this week, because there's the rocket. They've got nuclear potential. It was intercontinental for satellite, they said, but even so, now it's gone. But also, David Sanger points out, we're in an age where no government can just sit forever on anything. I mean, right up and including to the United States. Look at WikiLeaks. It's going to be out there. They've got the egg on their face, and they're talking about it.
Yes, and I join with Eleanor in thinking this is nothing to crow about. I mean, a self-humiliated regime there in front of its own people now, or at least some of them, as David indicates, that's dangerous, and one just doesn't know how they will react. I wonder if politically this something will be made of this. I see that Foreign Policy, which is usually an Obama-friendly publication, is criticizing the president this morning and his team for really being prematurely announcing and celebrating a February 29 deal that basically we were going to give them food aid and they were going to stand down from their nuclear tests. And the implication here is that we inadequately communicated our intentions. We didn't tell them very clearly, look, putting up the satellite, shooting the missile, that's a deal breaker. And that somehow they didn't get that message because it wasn't sent with sufficient firmness. I don't know whether the Republicans will take that up. I don't know whether it's a valid charge or not. But they quote arms control experts saying that we flubbed it in those negotiations.
David Sanger, 10 seconds. Was the Washington unclear with North Korea?
They certainly made the point to them that they couldn't do the space launch, but whether they made it forcefully enough, I don't know. And you saw Mitt Romney turn out a statement before that rocket hit the water.
Boom. Right away, off you go. David Sanger with the New York Times, please stand by. Eleanor Clift with Newsweek, our own. Jack Beatty is here. Listeners, you can join us. Did you fear North Korea's rocket? What's your parting word on Rick Santorum? And what's up with the flare-up on moms and work? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Santorum's out. George Zimmerman's in jail. The mommy wars are on again. And North Korea's rocket fizzles. Eleanor Clift is with us. She's with Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Joins us from Washington today. Her new book out next month is Selecting a President. David Sanger is with us, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. He's been busy writing as well. Coming out, early June, Confront and Conceal Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Look for that. Our own Jack Beatty is here, and you can join the conversation. What's your parting word on for Rick Santorum? What's up with the flare-up on moms and work? Why does, who does Ann Romney speak for? Does she speak for you? And will there be justice in the Trayvon Martin case? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Here was Rick Santorum bowing out of the GOP primary race this Tuesday, suspending, he said, in a speech in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, recapped his run as a defender of the Constitution and family values, vowed to fight on for those issues.
While this presidential race for us is over, for me, and we will suspend our campaign effective today, we are not done fighting. We are going to continue to fight for those voices. We're going to continue to fight for the Americans who stood up and gave us that air under our wings that allowed us to accomplish things that no political expert would have ever expected.
Rick Santorum suspending his primary campaign. Eleanor Clift in Washington, where does this leave the Mitt Romney, Barack Obama, and what is the lasting message of Rick Santorum's surprising long run here?
Well, Santorum notably did not endorse Mitt Romney. And
didn't
I think he's really angry. I mean, I think he believes that he would have had a very good chance at winning this nomination if he wasn't buried under an avalanche of money from Mitt Romney's super PACs. Now, that may or may not be true, but he leaves the race with a great deal of bitterness and is not ready to get on the Romney bandwagon. And I think Santorum has done Romney a lot of damage, I think, particularly in terms of the votes of women. I think the fact that he pursued his beliefs about contraception and his social values, which many people feel strongly about, but they are not a majority view, I think have really left Romney battling a gender gap that is larger than we've seen in some time. And Romney is now battling back about that, and that leads right into, of course, another one of the stories that you're featuring, which is the reignition of the mommy wars.
Yeah, no kidding. You can't get away from it. I mean, that one came out of these comments by Hillary Rosen, Democratic strategist, pundit, on Wednesday, advisor to the Democratic National Committee, I guess at one point anyway. She set off the firestorm. We'll talk about the nature of that. But with her comments on CNN, here she is. She said Ann Romney was out of touch with women because, quote unquote, she's never worked a day in her life.
What you have is Mitt Romney running around the country saying, well, you know, my wife tells me that what women really care about are economic issues. And when I listen to my wife, that's what I'm hearing. Guess what? His wife has actually never worked a day in her life. She's never really dealt with the kinds of economic issues that a majority of the women in this country are facing.
Ann Romney, who's been very prominent on the campaign trail, fired back very quickly with her first tweet, the first tweet of her life. And then on Fox News yesterday, chastised Hillary Rosen for saying she'd never worked a day in her life. Parenting, she said, was her career.
My career choice was to be a mother. And I think all of us need to know that we need to respect choices that women make. Other women make other choices to have a career and raise family, which I think Hillary Rosen has actually done herself. I respect that. That's wonderful. We have to respect women in all those choices that they make.
Let's go right to our listeners on this one. Marcy in Mechanicsville, Iowa. Marcy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
As a former working mom, now a stay-at-home mom, I can assure you that both jobs are equally taxing.
Yeah.
But my main point is that I'm kind of with Mrs. Romney on this one. It really irritates me. The mommy wars are bad enough as it is. I don't like them pitting women against women, mothers against mothers for political gain. It's hard enough to be a mom in general, and it's hard enough to be a human in a society, let alone having tempers flared at, you know, placing blame on one another all the time, constantly, for the choices that we decide to make for our family.
Yeah.
And some women are thrown into those choices.
Mm-hmm.
Some women choose to stay home, and that's wonderful. And it's wonderful for working moms. I mean, I've been on both sides of the coin, and sometimes there are days now when I long for those times when I could just drop her off at daycare and go grab a coffee and go to work.
Yeah, it's tough work either way. But what do you think when Ann Romney is on the stump with her husband campaigning, political campaigning, and talking about the economy, among other things, is it then fair game, or should we still leave that? President Obama is saying, hey, let's leave first ladies out of the, you know, the crossfire.
No, I agree. Leave them out. I'm with my president 100% on that one. I mean, I know that Michelle Obama was in the spotlight a lot as well. But for positive, but I mean,
well, sometimes positive and sometimes not. Marcy, I appreciate your call, and we've got a lot more. If I may, let me go to Allie in Lansing, Michigan. Allie, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
My
what do you think?
Point is that the Romney camp? This was a fake reaction from the Romney camp. The pundit was obviously talking about economics. He was obviously talking about job generation. So when she said hasn't worked a day in her life, to me it was obvious that she was talking about job generation, economics, working outside of the home. I've worked outside and inside of the home, and I'm very happy to work at home now, which works for me. But I would like to say that when I was a stay-at-home mom, I didn't have the life that Ann Romney had, and I don't think she should speak for stay-at-home moms. I don't have a chef. I don't have a, you know, housekeeper. I didn't have all those things. So Ann Romney trying to speak for stay-at-home moms, that's just really, it's fake.
Doesn't look like your life. Let me get a couple more here, and I'll come to my panel. Christine in Brantford, Connecticut. What do you think? You're on the air, Christine.
Hi, Tom. I was just going to say, Ann Romney said that she made the choice to be a mother, and a lot of us make the same choice, but a lot of us don't have the choice to just stay home. We also have to go out and make some money. And I don't know if she knows what it's like to do that, and I think to me that's why it just, you know, I kind of agree with the pundit. I mean, she doesn't speak for me, Ann Romney.
So maybe not well put by Hillary Rosen, but you're sympathetic to the impulse. And one more, Kay in Lincoln, Nebraska. Kay, you're on the air.
Well, hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
I totally agree with Ann Romney. I think that she said, as I recall, women, we need to respect women in all those choices they make, respect the choices that women make, in, you know, reverse order, I believe. I think that's absolutely true. I think we need to respect women's choices as to their health care. I think we need to respect women's choices as to their family timing so they can choose So they have an opportunity to choose whether or not to have a job outside the home to support their families if needed. I think we need to assume that women are capable of making choices and don't need to be lectured and delayed. And
so what are you saying here politically, Kay? Are you saying
I'm saying that I think there's a little bit of hypocrisy, or at least a failure to recognize that choice means choice. It doesn't mean I get to choose what I do, and I also get to choose what you do.
Yeah, Kay, I appreciate your call. Eleanor Cliff, let me bring it back to you, because here we are. I mean, there's been a big gap on the women's support front, and this fell right into it, which is no small part of what made it explosive, I guess. And Mitt Romney is already, with Ann Romney, been working hard on trying to scratch back on the female voter front. How do you think this is going to play out, Eleanor?
Well, Ann Romney is a very classy person, and she relates to voters. And I think women look at her and they feel that she's authentic and they like her. She is not somebody that the Democrats need to take on. And so this was a remark that just opened the door for the Romney campaign to try to make up some of the lost ground with women. I agree with the caller who said it's a bit of a fake reaction, because Hillary Rosen... It was clear to anyone who's lived through any of the mommy wars that she was talking about working outside the home and balancing those economic interests with raising a family. And somebody with the wealth of the Romneys does not face those choices, although I'm sure she has her own juggling act. Women in her position have been the backbone of volunteer activity, and many communities have suffered because there are fewer women in a position who are able to do that. So this does, as one of the other callers said, it pits women against women for political gain. I think it makes all of us cringe. And for me, I had three children and I've worked. And I always said that one was therapy for the other. I couldn't have been a full stay-at-home wife. It's really a mother. It's really hard work. Going to the office was a relief. On the other hand, when you're working and you have kids at home, you're always worried that you're not giving them enough. And so it's a friction that many people live every day. And to see it now turned in once again into a political issue is really kind of frustrating.
Jack, this got hot in a hurry. I'm looking at online comments here. You know, here's one. Ann Romney's raised more kids than Obama has created jobs. Retweeted again and again. On the other hand, here's Carol talking about Mother Ann Romney. Two nannies, a cook, a housekeeper, a driver, a mansion, unlimited bucks. Mothering is so difficult. She writes. How do you think this plays, Jeff?
Well, you know, to me, it's an object lesson in meme, M-E-M-E, manufacture. Within hours of its utterance, Ms. Rosen's comment was, you know, all over the Twitterverse, force-fed, no doubt, by GOP Twitterati. And it created really a perfect Twitter storm of faux indignation based on a disputed, if not doubtful, claim that she, Ms. Rosen, was or is a paid Obama advisor. And rightfully, the Democrats say this is to distract from the Republican gender gap, just dramatized this week in new polls. On the other hand, the Republicans are right, I think, when they charge that the Democrats, quote, war on women meme is itself a distraction, this one from the bad economy. There's this difference, though. The Democrats aren't hyperbolizing from sheerest nothing. I mean, across the country, GOP legislatures have passed something, scores, some people say around 100 bills last year and this year, either restricting abortion rights, access to contraceptions, and other health care for women. And, of course, in Washington, we've had the Blount Amendment, which would effectively allow employers to push women off from insurance. So there's something going on, and maybe it's not a war on women, but it's certainly a Republican effort to pander to their own constituents.
Mitt Romney certainly courting female votes this week. He was in Hartford, Connecticut at a rally, and there he accused President Obama of waging a war on women with his economic policies.
In his 3.5 years, 92.3% of the people who've lost jobs have been women. His failures have hurt women. More information. What president has the worst record on female labor force participation? Barack Obama. In history, we've gone back 20 years. The progress that was made of more women getting into the workforce has been stepped back 20 years by virtue of this president's policies.
David Sanger, chief White House correspondent for the New York Times. President Obama himself came out very quickly in the last 24 hours saying, hey, let's not jump on first ladies in the process of campaigning. How does this play out?
Well, the first thing is that you've seen Mitt Romney and their whole campaign try to use the Hillary Rosen comment, whether it was in context or out of context, to try to close up what the polls show is this huge gender gap. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure Ms. Rosen did not do this deliberately, but she has certainly helped the Romney campaign in doing that, because it has taken a lot of the edge off of the Democrats' claims about Romney. And this is one of the big things that Romney's got to get done between now and the Republican convention. You know, with Rick Santorum out of the way, the time has begun for Romney's long mm-hmm. walk back to the center. Mm-hmm. And the length of this fight has made that walk longer and harder. And the fact that Newt Gingrich is still in mm-hmm. the campaign with the avowed goal of keeping Romney from moving back to the center is going to make it harder. So, you know, this all, I think, will help Romney. Whether it will help him enough with women's votes, I have reason to doubt.
In the Etch-a-Sketch moment, let me turn to another mother this week, the mother of Trayvon Martin. Of course, big news this week with the charge, second-degree murder against George Zimmerman, and he is now in jail. She was on the Today Show yesterday, Sabrina Fulton, saying she believed her son was killed in an accident, but then she kind of walked back from that. She appeared later on CNN to clarify what she thinks of her son's shooter, George Zimmerman.
There are good people and there are bad people. And I just believe he's a human being. I don't have any hate for him in my heart. I lost my child, and that hurts me a great deal. So I just want him to be held accountable for what he's done.
Eleanor Clift, here we are. There was so much passion about this, rallies and people in the streets and talk all over this country. And now there's an arrest, and there are charges, and they're essentially the toughest charges that the special prosecutor could have brought under the circumstances. Where does this leave the case? Where does this leave the country looking at the case, Eleanor?
Well, now the wheels of justice begin to grind, and there is some question about whether the case will ever get to a jury. In Florida, judges face election, and so I think a judge may be worried about deciding this case on his or her own and may bounce it to a jury, in which case I think we would have a televised spectacle that would go on for some time. Think the Kaylee Martin case recently from Florida. And then you have the prosecutor, who I think has taken a very strong stand, but she says, look, we have argued a number of these cases out. Some we've won, some we haven't. And Florida's Stand Your Ground law does seem to offer George Zimmerman some measure of protection. And so I think this is going to be now, instead of debated on cable TV, it moves to the courtroom.
Let's go to Steve in Dothan, Alabama. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I was really troubled with your coverage yesterday, because even your state senator and the Florida lawyers were trying to sit there and soften the harsh rhetoric anti-Zimmerman, because there are so many other facts in this case that just doesn't make it to NBC and ABC and even on NPR. People kind of gloss over the facts, and it's amazing when you watch the full coverage of the unedited raw videos and audios that perhaps maybe Zimmerman is telling the truth and maybe he was writing and walking back and got attacked. He lost contact with the kid. But that doesn't have any play. And the problem is when this guy gets not convicted, there's going to, you know, there's so much fuel and fire going on that that's going to create even a further storm. You know,
Steve, I agree there's fuel and fire, but wasn't the call that was there was for, let's have a trial here. Let's not just have a couple of policemen decide on the scene and be done with it. Isn't there some...
That's the thing. And yes, there should be a trial. There should be a board of inquiry. There should be a something. But my God, this guy went into hiding because he is feared for his life. Because the new Black Panthers put a bounty on his head publicly, and the Justice Department lets that go voluntarily. If anybody put a bounty on your head publicly, that's a federal crime and a federal offense. Where's Eric Holder holding them up?
Steve, we hear you loud and clear. Loud and clear. On the other hand, Trayvon Martin is dead. We'll come back and look at all the news of the week. Steve, thanks for your call. David Sanger, please stand by. Eleanor Clift in Washington. Jack Beatty, we're looking at a week in the news. Santorum out of the primary race. George Zimmerman in jail. Mommy wars on again. And North Korean rocket freezing up there. You can join us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, or check us out online or give us a comment there at onpointradio.org. It is a very lively discussion. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, an 8.6 magnitude earthquake off Sumatra in Indonesia brought memories of the great tsunami, but no tsunami disaster this time.
As the earthquake struck, people in Banda Aceh fled from buildings and spilled onto the streets. The earth shook for over a minute.
Two white men confessed to shooting five black Oklahomans in Tulsa on Good Friday. Here's Tulsa Police Chief Chuck Jordan.
It sickens me. It angers me. This is not what Tulsa, Oklahoma is about.
And self-taught man of emotion, Bubba Watson, wins the Masters Golf Tournament with a miracle 160-yard shot. He spoke afterward about the influence of his late father.
The way he raised me as a son, as a man, he probably could care less now about the golf. I know he's probably watching from heaven, but probably the man is more important to him than the Masters Championship.
Congratulations, Bubba Watson. We're looking at a week in the news. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, is with us. Look for his new book, Confront and Conceal, out in June. Eleanor Clift is with us, contributing editor at Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Her new book out next month is Selecting a President. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What about George Zimmerman? What about the world and Syria? Are we on the right path here? What's up with Alan West saying communists in Congress? And are you with President Obama on the Buffett rule or not? Have we had price fixing on e-books? Can you picture John Edwards behind bars? And were the Marlins right to suspend Ozzie Guillen for giving love to Castro? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Nate in Omaha, Nebraska. Nate, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for your honest discussion every day. I'd like to say I'm a white male. I have a mixed half-black kid.
Mm-hmm.
He's 16. So the Trayvon Martin case hit particularly close to home.
You mean, this is your son. You're talking about your son here, Nate.
Yes, my mm-hmm. son. He's mm-hmm. 16.
Very
he's
good.
Half-black.
Yeah.
And so the Trayvon Martin thing, you know, there's claims from the right that Zimmerman may have tutored African-American kids and that he's not a racist. And I'd like to say that I think it's possible to racially profile someone and not be racist. These stereotypes are so pervasive in our society that we all carry them. And I think that's the reason we have so many young black men in jail because of the war on drugs and these stereotypes that are just everywhere in our culture. I think we effectively have a war on young black men, and in order to turn this around, the first step is we have to admit that we all carry these biases.
Nate, you make a good point about the nuance of this, some empathy there, and being careful about casting the first stone, and point taken. At the same time, here's a young man who's dead, and now the court system will decide. We'll all wait for that, but I appreciate your call from that unique perspective you've got. Not so unique these days, but even so. Pete in Oakville, Ontario, Canada. Pete, thank you for calling.
Yes, hello, Tom. It seems that in the U.S., race relations have deteriorated and tensions have risen due to recent events. But it seems to me that the issue of race may once again re-enter politics in the upcoming campaign. And it struck me that Mr. Mitt Romney remains absolutely silent on the Trayvon Martin case and the other related shootings, which might have some racial overtones or undertones.
Interesting. Eleanor Clift, what about this case in the context of the election campaign? I mean, the president commented on it, said if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin. That seemed kind of maybe self-evident, but he got flack from the conservatives for that. As this, if this case goes forward and rolls out during the presidential campaign, what about that admixture, Eleanor?
Well, we tend to separate into two societies when it comes to politics, and there are two medias. Listen to Fox News versus MSNBC, and you'll get a very different perspective on the Trayvon Martin case if you watch Fox than if you watch MSNBC. But I think both Mitt Romney and President Obama are it's I don't think it's in their either of their interest to have racial polarity get to the point where it simmers to the surface and they have to address it. I agree. I think it's always underground, but I still think the two leading candidates here are better than that.
Let's give the last word on this one to Trayvon's father, Tracy Martin. He was reacting here at a press conference on Wednesday to the arrest and second-degree murder charges against George Zimmerman.
We will continue to hold hands on this journey. White, black, Hispanic, Latino, we will continue to walk. We will march and march and march until the right thing is done.
There we are, Trayvon Martin, and much more to come on that. The whole country will be watching very closely. President Obama talking this week a lot about taxes and what it's called the Buffett rule. Recalled in a clip here, Ronald Reagan's belief that it was crazy for a bus driver to pay more taxes than a multimillionaire.
That wild-eyed socialist tax-hiking class warrior was Ronald Reagan. He thought that in America, the wealthiest should pay their fair share, and he said so. I know that position might disqualify him from the Republican primaries these days, but what Ronald Reagan was calling for then is the same thing that we're calling for now, a return to basic fairness and responsibility, everybody doing their part. And if it'll help convince folks in Congress to make the right choice, we could call it the Reagan rule instead of the Buffett rule.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the president's push this week on more revenues from the wealthiest American, the Buffett rule?
Well, good for him, and I wish he were talking about equalizing taxes on between earned and unearned income, which is, for most Americans, an inconceivable idea, unearned income. But you know, this week the president got some good news on polls, showed him doing well with women and much more popular, much more likable by almost 40 points than Mitt Romney. On the other hand, Third Way, a self-styled moderate political institution, came out with a big survey of what they call swing independents. And the headline says it all, Opportunity Trumps Fairness with Swing Independents. These voters, whom Third Way thinks will decide the election, don't want to hear about fairness. They don't think the country is rigged. They're worried about inequality, but it's way down on their list. They don't want to hear a president talking about we want to tax the rich. They want to hear a president talking about how opportunity will be extended. They want to hear a president talking about economic growth. Of course, both of these are in Mitt Romney's wheelhouse. And the warning to the president in this poll seems to me clear. The more he talks about fairness, Democrats like it. They want to hear it. But according to the findings of the Third Way, this doesn't register with these independent voters, this particular class of them. And one reason seems to be that 90% of them are confident that they can pay their bills over the next year. Well, that's not all of us are in that position. But a clear caution to the president that fairness may not be the best issue for the Democrats.
And there was this note this week. This one really, really came zinging in. This was a town hall event Tuesday in Jensen Beach, Florida, around money and class. And Republican Congressman Alan West was there. And he was asked by a member of the audience, what percentage of the American legislature do you think are card-carrying Marxists? Talking about Congress. Congressman West said it was a fair question. And he answered with a straight-up estimate. Now, the sound quality is rough, but listen closely to U.S. Congressman Alan West.
I believe there's about 78 to 81 members of the Democratic Party that are members of the Communist Party.
78 to 81 Democrats, members of the Communist Party, called them out as the Progressive Caucus. Eleanor Clift, what the heck is that?
Well, there is a progressive caucus, and they are liberals, and he's equating liberals with communists, I guess. He's taking it one step further. He's gone beyond socialism. You know, it's a kind of a laugh line. I don't.
But he didn't laugh. There wasn't even a smirk.
No, it's a laugh line for people listening. I mean, the Communist Party has been moribund in this country for a very long time.
And this is a guy Sarah Palin said should be Mitt Romney's running mate.
Well, it says something about Sarah Palin and the Republican Party that they pander to somebody like this who said this isn't the first outrageous thing he said. And he is facing a challenge, so maybe he won't be back in the Congress. But I wanted to talk about the fairness issue. Mm-hmm. I think President Obama does link it to opportunity. I mean, basically, he uses the same formulation that Bill Clinton did, that you know, if you play by the rules, you should get the opportunities. And I think there is a strong sense in the society that the tax code is rigged so that the people at the very top don't pay their fair share. So I think it's a pretty good issue. And this last week, he brought all these millionaires, patriotic millionaires, I guess. Mm. It's sort of like superheroes. And they showed up at the White House. And there are people who are in this tax bracket or are basically saying, you know, tax me some more. They're more Warren Buffetts.
Plenty of people
so
saying
I think it's a gimmick, but it also would raise real money.
Of course, and issues in high inequality for economic health, many economists have said. David?
Well, you know, Tom, it strikes me, I mean, obviously this is tax week for everybody. I mean, a lot of people this weekend who are sitting down.
Grinding it out
at the kitchen table, trying to get those returns in by Monday. And so the president has timed this quite carefully. He has done so because he knows a lot of people are going to be doing this weekend, mm-hmm. and they're going to be – their mind will be
it's
focused
no fun,
in the
it
way
mm-hmm. –
it's no fun, and they'll be – their mind will be focused when they hit that bottom line and they think about that 16% effective tax rate that Mitt Romney paid.
On his $21 million in gains last year.
That's right. And, you know, the president has not talked very much about that. He sort of let others, you know, mm-hmm. go off and do that for him. But people are going to be calculating one way or another – even if it's only in rough terms, their own effective tax rate. And so, you know, I'm with Eleanor. I think this is a significant issue for the president. It may be an issue of declining value. But if it's got a peak as a value to him, it's probably this week.
Maybe right now. And Mitt Romney will go all the way to voting day with his own wealth, of course, behind him. Amin in Winthrop, Massachusetts. Amin, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi. And lady. Yes, Amin.
Yes, I just want to comment on the Syrian revolution, and I really want to say, you know, something that right now, you know, it's an ideal time for the U.S. to lead once again on this, because it is the U.S. that's going to lead, not Europe, not everybody else. You know, right now, public Arab opinion and Muslim Arab opinion and in general the world opinion is more than outraged at the massacres that are being committed right now by the Syrian regime. 85% of the Syrian people have been revolting for over a year. You know, my suggestions, if it was up to me, I would lead a coalition, and the Arabs are more than willing. There was, right now, as you probably know, the Gulf states are fully financing diplomatically from weapons, you name it. Every single support is coming from the Gulf. All the Arabs, including Egypt, which is the most important player there, it is in their interest to get Syria out of the Shia-Iranian axis, which is right now from Iran to Iraq to Syria to Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Yeah.
And one thing that there is no way besides this, there is no way out right now besides surgical strikes, Yugoslavian style, hit every single tank that moves, hit the military installation.
And who should do it? I mean, who should do it, those surgical strikes?
I think there is we are the indispensable power. I've watched this for
we've got it. Our time is short. U.S. surgical strikes in Syria, that of course that was we've got it. I mean, that wasn't the tune of this week. I mean, there is a shaky ceasefire there. I've got a little tape and I'll bring it to you, David Sanger. But here was Hillary Clinton yesterday saying Syria must adhere to the peace process outlined by the United Nations. She talked in Washington after a meeting with Jihadi foreign ministers about Kofi Annan's efforts there.
The Annan plan is not a menu of options. It is a set of obligations. The burden of fully and visibly meeting all of these obligations continues to rest with the regime. They cannot pick and choose. For it to be meaningful, this apparent halt in violence must lead to a credible political process and a peaceful, inclusive, democratic transition.
Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State yesterday, David Sanger, our caller Amin doesn't seem to be buying it. He still wants surgical strikes, U.S. strikes on every tank that moves there, and there has been a lot of death and suffering. But where are we now? There is some kind of ceasefire, at least at the moment. Where does Syria stand?
Well, Syria has promised ceasefires before. This one seems to have at least started. Whether it will hold, we don't know. There's a lot of reason to suspect it won't. So that takes you to Hillary Clinton's statement that this isn't a menu of options, it's an obligation. Mm-hmm. What was missing from her statement was the or else.
Mm-hmm.
And our caller, Amin, was trying to suggest what that or else is.
Bombs away.
Bombs away. The difficulty with that is this isn't Libya. Okay, the geography is very different. In Libya, you had armies approaching Benghazi. They were out in the desert. It was possible to bomb them without having to worry about collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
The struggle in Syria has been entirely
right
in the cities,
mm-hmm.
very tight neighborhoods, great concern about collateral damage, even if you use the most precision U.S. weapons. I would be very surprised if you saw President Obama take that option, because frankly, if he felt that he could have taken that option, he would have done it months
but
ago.
But Amin says, you know, you've got Gulf states and everybody else pouring all kinds of support into the opposition there. Have we reached a moment of change? Is he going somewhere, Assad, or what do you think's happening?
You know, my guess is he will go. Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, was over at Harvard across the river last night. He said that he thought that Assad was a goner, but he couldn't predict when. And so the question then is, are you willing to sit back with the knowledge that thousands more may die between now and the time Assad leaves if you think Dempsey's right?
Amin talked about a Shia axis going from Iran to Syria and beyond. What about Iran? Talks coming right in front of us here on Iran and its nuclear situation. It's been in a tight box lately by the rest of the world. What's coming?
What's coming right now is the first negotiations between the United States, the European powers, and Iran in 2.5 years. President Obama has sent a pretty clear message to the Supreme Leader through the Prime Minister of Turkey that this is a last chance. I think what he means by that is if these fall apart, you're probably going to hear the Israelis begin to move.
Move as in strike Iran? Does that mean U.S. at war?
It does mean the U.S. could end up getting sucked into something. I don't think we're thinking, from what you're hearing President Obama say, anybody talking about occupying Iran or anything like that. But I do believe that if the Israelis struck and the Iranians responded, almost every war game that you see that gets played out at the Pentagon by private groups, the U.S. gets sucked into it sooner or later.
Oh, boy. We've barely begun to really see how the table may change before the voting actually takes place. Watch that space and the whole, penumbra around it. Very grateful to all three of you for being with us today. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us here, David.
Thank you, Tom.
Eleanor Clift with Newsweek and The Daily Beast joining us from Washington, D.C. Thank you, Eleanor.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, have a great weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
This is On Point.